Mr. DeMille. I'm ready for my close-up.
I'll show up sometime. See me.
Aiden Bond! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, sir.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hi, Wendy here. Before we start off our episode today, I want to remind everybody to check us out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Also, please leave a rating or comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can find us on social media by simply searching Silver Screen Time Machine, and please make sure you follow our podcast, Silver Screen Time Machine, anywhere you get your podcast. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review. Today we have a guest, second-time guest, Stuart.
Yes, I'm back with a little less murder and mayhem. There is death, but not as much murder and mayhem and somnambulistic killings.
Yes, the last time you were here, we were doing The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And since you're here, we must be talking about another silent film. But first, before we get into that, Stuart, why don't you tell us a little bit about your podcast?
Hi, my name's Stuart. I run the Golden Silent Films podcast, where we cover everything silent film and silent film adjacent. We do a little bit of everything, biographies, movie reviews, even weird off-tangent things like advertising or stuff like that.
You're a prolific podcaster. I am impressed with your podcasting abilities.
Yes, a little too much sometimes. I've been told my episodes can get a little too long and a little too much information.
Oh, no, nobody can ever have too much information. Well, I thank you for joining us again. I'm excited to talk about this film. So we are getting in our time machine and we are going back to 1926 and we are going to talk about...
Flesh and the Devil.
Flesh and the Devil. Oh, Stuart, this is one of my favorite silent films.
And after watching it for the first time, I can tell why. It is a great, great film.
This is actually the first silent film I ever saw.
Really?
And I think that's why it holds a little special part in my heart. But I had never seen a silent film before. This was on TCM. They were doing a Greta Garbo marathon or something. And I started to watch this, and I was very spellbound by this film. And I just have always really loved it since then. But this film, well, we'll start out by saying it won no Academy Awards, and there's a very good reason why that was, because there was no such thing as the Academy Awards. So, I mean, it may have won some if there had been an Academy Awards.
And the movie that won the first Academy Award kind of made me think of this. It's like the reverse, the mirror image of Wings, which was one of the first. There's a lot of opposites and similarities between the two films.
Oh, yeah. I've actually never seen Wings.
Oh, you're missing out.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look that one up. So actually, the first Academy Awards was in 1929, and it evaluated movies from 1927 to 1928. Since this was 1926, it missed out. This is based on a novel, The Undying Past, by Herman Suderman. Am I saying?
That would be my best guess as well, as I was reading about him.
He was from the province of Prussia. They say it's now modern-day Lithuania, I guess. And an interesting thing about Suderman is that he was a Mennonite. He came from a Mennonite family, which I think probably you kind of see the religious reflection, obviously, in this film.
There's definitely some points where that would that would make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. He would move to Berlin and become a journalist and would eventually write novels and plays, many of which were performed on the stage and made into film, particularly in Japan, where he was very popular. He had about 30 of his things adapted into film in Japan.
Interesting.
He's
one of the first examples of big in Japan, you hear. People talk about being big in Japan, and he's number one specifically,
but much beloved in Japan. And besides this film, he actually, another very famous silent film was adapted from his works, Sunrise by Murnau.
Yes. Yeah, very good one.
Yeah, it is. It's an excellent film. So he kind of has this very human thing. What would you describe his sort of works? First of all, the very moral sense in his works of good
very
and bad.
Earthy. I think of earthy, very down to earth, like regular people in regular situations. Right. Very, I don't know. If it was America, very Midwestern sensibility to it.
Yeah. And they said, I think when he was younger, he lived in a lower class type family. And he does tend to reflect that a lot in some of his, not this, obviously. In Flesh and the Devil, nobody is poor in this film. No. Well, maybe Felicitas is poor, but I mean, maybe she was raised poor. We don't know. Anyhow, before we get to that, the screenplay by Benjamin Glazer, which is weird when you say the screenplay for a silent film, but they did have scripts. People think there was no scripts, but there were. There were. He was the winner of two Oscars, Arise, My Love, and Seventh Heaven. He was born in Belfast, but his parents were Hungarian, and he is one of the founding members of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which is the academy that presents the Academy Awards.
That's one thing that's interesting. When you look at all these old movies, so many of the people involved with either the making, the acting, the writing, a lot of them were that first class of people that were on the board of the Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
And then it's kind of funny because... Like we said, he was awarded the Oscar for Seventh Heaven. That was the first Oscar for writing in the first Academy Awards, and he was a founding member. Is that a coincidence?
Sure, nothing. I had nothing to do with it whatsoever.
No, how odd. But he's also known for, actually, these were kind of surprising to me. He's known for A Farewell to Arms and Tortilla Flat. And he also adapted another Suderman story to film in The Song of Songs, which starred Marlene Dietrich. And he made the first translation of author-playwright Ferenc Molnár's, am I saying that right? His play Lilium into English from the original Hungarian, and that actually was the known translation or the accepted translation through every variety. That was eventually adapted to Carousel, the movie, the musical Carousel.
Oh, interesting. Never knew that.
So I'm guessing maybe, possibly, I'm assuming that Suderman didn't write this novel. He didn't write this in English, I'm assuming.
No, I forget. I read the original German title, but I can't remember it off the top of my head.
It's The Undying...
But the English title was the...
Oh, the English title.
The English title was The
Undying Past.
Undying Past, yeah.
Which I really like Flesh and the Devil better.
Yeah.
The Undying Past seems kind of strange. But
yeah, sometimes you get really weird, boring titles for movies from the book. And then sometimes it's the other way around.
Yeah, so I do wonder then if Glazer actually translated his book into English. I don't know. Onwards. Director Clarence Brown, nominated for 6 Oscars, and he never won, which is a record.
Well,
he has a little record going.
The Buffalo Bills.
Was the only director nominated for the most amount of Oscars and never won. Yeah. That's a not very happy record. Yeah. He was a fighter pilot and flight instructor in the U.S. Army during World War I. He originally had an auto dealership, but he became interested in movies and would eventually work with MGM long term. He did numerous silent films. He did 7 with Greta Garbo, and he's actually known also for National Velvet and The Yearling, which are kind of more children.
Never seen those. So.
Yeah, more children's type films.
Interesting.
But he lived to be 97 years old, Clarence Brown.
Not too shabby.
And next, the cinematographer, William Daniels. Okay, I really, really want to talk about this guy because I think the cinematography in this particular film is quite impressive.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah, so he was nominated for 4 Oscars. He won for The Naked City. It says he was a master at black and white cinematography and lighting, which you can tell just by looking at this film. He worked with Greta Garbo on 21 films. It's often said he was responsible for her success by the way that he lit her.
I can see it. I mean, when her face and her emotion and her eyes are the key thing about her performances, that you can see why that was such a great match.
He was her personal cinematographer. She took him on all her films. He did 21 films with her. It says, as a matter of fact, that brings me to my next point. Greta Garbo was so impressed with Clarence Brown's direction and William Daniels' cinematography that she continued to work with both of them in her subsequent films at MGM. And she was particularly insistent on the use of Daniels as her prime cinematographer. So here's a little bit more about Daniels. It said, in his biography of producer Mark Hellinger, who produced The Naked City, which is the movie he won the Academy Award for, Jim Bishop, who was the biographer, said, quote, in the old silent days, Daniels had been the best of them all. His camera work was so close to art that producers and directors and cameraman used to sit in private projection rooms, not to judge a picture, but to see what new tricks of lighting and effects Daniels had achieved. The industry acknowledged that Daniels' work was so fine that other cameramen were never censored for shamelessly stealing it.
There's a couple points when we start to talk about the movie.
Yeah.
Some scenes that really stood out to me that we'll go over. But yeah, there's some beautiful, beautiful stuff.
It's wonderful. Frank Sinatra was also impressed with Daniels after working with him on Some Come Running. And he used him on 9 more of his films that he produced or co-produced. Daniels was 50 years in the business as a cinematographer. Some other films he was known for, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, interesting.
The shop around the corner, Harvey and Ninochka. I never can say that one right.
It's very interesting when, before you dive in deep into these things, we're like, you watch these movies without knowing the behind-the-scenes stuff, but then when you look through someone's resume, someone's filmography, you're like, well, I've seen all of those, or I love all those movies. Yeah, I never realized that one person was responsible for
Yeah, and that's true. You often don't pay attention as you're watching a movie. You're not looking on the credits, who's the cinematographer. Yeah. I mean, granted, I do. Admittedly, I always look for the cinematographer, but I've certainly seen Shop Around the Corner and never noticed that it was him, per se. Oh, this is the same guy that did Flesh and the Devil.
Like when I watched stuff when I was younger, just watching the movie.
Yeah, just watching the movie.
But now that you have podcasts and you're really getting into this stuff, then you start to put all the pieces together. It's pretty amazing the careers that some of these people put together.
Yeah, it's what I like about doing the podcast is to sort of show folks that you don't just have to focus on one element of a movie. There's a whole team of effort that's coming together to make this movie phenomenal. It's not just about the story and the acting.
Very much so.
Yeah. Speaking of another aspect of movies, the music by Carl Davis. I think this is a fantastic score.
Very, very, very good. The version I watched on YouTube had the Carl Davis score, so I was,
mine too.
That works out good. So
I think that is the known score for this film.
Yeah.
Because they said that Davis was commissioned to make a lot of these in the 80s and 90s. He made a lot of these silent film scores for these. He did it for Ben-Hur. He made a new score for Ben-Hur, for The Phantom of the Opera, for Safety Last, for City Lights, and Greed, and Flesh and the Devil. So apparently he was the man to make these new scores. Whenever they needed one, they called him.
And he did an amazing job.
Yeah, he's very symphonic,
yes.
I think, with his... It says on several occasions he conducted these scores live in the cinema or in concert hall as the film was being screened, which would have been really cool to see.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing, I don't know if you know or are aware of this, but I know this, but he did the music for the British 1995 miniseries Pride and Prejudice, which is the considered the best Pride and Prejudice with Colin.
There's no better Mr. Darcy,
Colin
as I've
Firth.
Been told.
Oh, you have seen it. And the music is lovely in that. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. Editor Lloyd Nosler. I didn't have a lot about him. He worked his way up from an office boy to an editor at Universal, and then he would get signed by MGM because his abilities to edit action film. He was supposed to be very good at that. He was an editor on the silent film version of Ben-Hur. And then he also worked with Garbo on her previous film, The Temptress. So that's my notes on the crew. And do you have any other notes on the crew?
No, I think I'm ready to talk about the
ready
movie.
Go into the movie and then we can talk about the actors as we get into it. All right, let's start at the beginning then.
About the very, very beginning. Because on my podcast, the Golden Silent Films podcast, we're in the midst of a world tour season where every episode is either a foreign film, starring someone from another country, made by someone from another country, or the story takes place in another country. And this movie, Flesh and the Devil, is basically a United Nations effort of filmmaking. Because you had John Gilbert, star, as Leo, American. Greta Garbo and Lars Hansen, Swedish. You had Barbara Kent, who played Hertha. She was from Alberta, Canada. You had William Orlemann from Copenhagen, Denmark. You had a couple Americans, but you also had Eugenie Besserer, who played Leo's mother, from France. You had Mark McDermott from New South Wales, Australia. And Mina, played by Marcel Corday, from Brussels, Belgium. So really, a movie can't be more worldwide than this one is, actually.
And is not this movie supposed to be based in Germany?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It doesn't really say. It's very vague.
My history is very poor, but I don't, like, between Austria and all that, I don't know, the time frames. But basically Germany, yes.
Yes. And what is the time frame of this film? What year is this supposed to be?
I just assumed it was World War One, or...
So this is my thought on this. At one point, which we'll get to, Leo is exiled to Southwest Africa, right?
Yeah.
And that was a German colony from 1884 to 1915. So it had to have been within that time frame. I don't think it was in... This film was set in the 1800s.
Yeah.
So my guess is it's in the 1911... Because remember, he was there for 3 years.
Yeah.
So it may be 1912, 1911...
That was probably just my brain added, because they were coming back from some sort of either, I guess, boot camp or war.
Yeah, they're
or somewhere.
In like a, they're barracks. In a, they're barracks. Yeah, yeah, they're in like a platoon.
So I figured they were coming back from somewhere, but So I just assumed it was World War One, but I could
vague.
Be, yeah.
And it can be even more confusing because if the time frame is indeed 1910, 1911, 1912, Greta Garbo and Barbara Kent are not dressed appropriately for that. They are dressed like the people dressed in 1926.
Yeah, there's... Which, she was very fashion forward for 1910.
She knew the fashions 10 years before they even came into existence.
That's why she was such a fashion icon, I suppose.
That's true. So the first scene we have is at the, as you said, at what we will say the barracks. They're at a military barracks of some sort. And we see Ulrich. He's the first, kind of the first person we see. He's played by, as you said, Lars Hansen. Lars Hansen was, as you said, a Swedish actor. He was actually a great Shakespearean and theater actor in Sweden. And they said he had the ability to disguise himself to look unrecognizable, even to the people that saw him all the time. They wouldn't even, they walk right by him, wouldn't recognize him. He did film acting in Sweden with Greta Garbo before he came to the U.S. And then he was brought to the U.S. at the request of Lillian Gish to do The Scarlet Letter. And he also starred with her in The Wind, which is a really nice, really good film. And he returned to Sweden when talkies became popular in the States, and he would continue in Swedish films until the 1950s, as well as continued on the stage. He was considered a premier actor in Sweden.
Very much so.
Yeah, this great stage actor.
And his connections in Gösta Berling's saga with Greta Garbo and Moritz Stiller, and then Moritz Stiller connections to Greta Garbo, getting Greta Garbo... It's all a nice little circle of everyone getting their time
shine. I guess the film industry in Sweden was pretty small.
Yes.
It was
pretty small. You had a handful of big-time directors, and Moritz Stiller was one of the biggest. And they really were able to fine-tune their craft and hone it. And then by the time they came to America to make some stuff, they were in prime working condition.
Yeah, and they didn't have to worry about their Swedish accents because we were in silent films, at least not at first. So Ulrich, played by Lars Hansen, he realizes that his friend is missing. He notices that he's not in his bunk, I guess. And then they have to go do their little roll call thing. And they're calling, his friend's name is Leo. They're calling this Leo's name. And he has to say, first he puts stuff in his bed to make it look like he's there. He gathers all this stuff and creates a look like somebody's sleeping in the bed. And then when he's being called, he says, he's sick. One of the things I really liked when the military guys are stepping forward as their name are called, they do these swish pans. I don't know if you noticed. I thought that was really cool, especially for 1926. I thought that looked really
neat. There's a lot of stuff going on in this movie.
There's a lot of great camera techniques.
Yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff going on.
Yeah, so what we find out, then they go back and look. There is some comedy in this movie, too, actually. This movie has comedic moments.
That was one of the things that surprised me.
Yeah.
Because the first little bit, there's quite a bit of comedy.
Yeah, there is.
So I was like, all right, this is going to be a fun romp. This is going to be a lot of shenanigans.
Then,
like, once the turning point happens...
Yeah.
Comedy's gone.
But in the beginning, it is kind of funny because they come back to the bunk and Ulrich still believes that his stuff that he's made to look like a man is there. Yeah. And he's getting scared because the sergeant, whoever is in charge, the head military person, he draws back the covers and Ulrich's cowering like, oh, no. And there's John Gilbert as Leo and he's in his bed. And they do this little pantomime that's quite funny where he's behind the sergeant or whatever. Let's just call him a sergeant. Yeah. I don't know what he is. Captain. I don't know. He's behind the captain or whatever, making these gestures at John Gilbert, Leo, to tell him, oh, pretend you're sick, stuff like that. And it works. And the guy's like, oh, well, okay, you stay and nurse him. And then as soon as the sergeant slash captain slash general, whatever he is, goes out the door, they jump up and they start celebrating. And then before you know it, they're so busy in their celebration that they fail to notice that the guys come back in. And he's like, okay, you're under arrest. I guess you get arrested for that in the German army.
And then you have to pick up horse manure.
Horse manure. Yeah. Did you see the steam coming from the horse?
That was one of my notes. The commitment to the horse poop gag was phenomenal.
So wonder why they did that. Just because they wanted to make it look like steaming horse manure?
Yeah,
I guess for
ultimate cinema verite.
Yeah, I was a little bewildered by that.
And then just when Leo gets it finished, they have to throw in one more quick gag where he has to get one more shovel full the horse.
It is funny how they had this kind of comical beginning.
Yeah, you would think the whole movie was just going to be zany shenanigans, but no. Yeah.
I guess a little bit about John Gilbert. He had a very unfortunate life. his childhood was quite horrible. His mother was a stock stage actress, and she basically didn't really, I don't think, want to be saddled with a child. She was trying to further her acting career. There'd be points where she would lock him in the closet for hours and hours on end because she was busy and she didn't want him. Yeah, he had a very hard childhood. And he wound up hating his mother. He could not stand her, and he wasn't even sad when she died. And he eventually made his way to Hollywood. Started out as a screenwriter, did some screenwriting, did some directing before starting to get some bit roles in movies, and then he sort of became this leading man. He began doing some leading roles, but then I think what really catapulted him was the death of Rudolph Valentino. So you had this great heartthrob silent film star, and when he died, everybody was looking for the next one.
Who's next?
He just happened to be right there and fit into the bill. So I think that's what wound up happening with him. But he died very young. He died at the age of 38. He was a severe alcoholic. He had a very serious alcohol issue, and it sort of did him in. I think he had numerous heart attacks. They also said he had a bleeding ulcer. He was just not in good shape.
On screen, he was the movies I've seen of his, I love the guy. He carries himself super cool.
Yeah.
Like, he's just about as cool as can be.
Yes.
And love, like, He Who Gets Slapped, the show where he was, Todd Browning's The Show, where he was Cock Robin. Like, he's the coolest guy around.
Yeah, I think one of his best performances is in The Big Parade. He's quite amazing in that film, and he carries that film beautifully, and he does a lot of very subtle, excellent acting in that film. He does tend to sometimes make some kind of over-the-top expressions, but they're very John Gilbert, and you kind of have to expect. When he sees the love interest of his eyes pop out like he's Pepe Le Pew. What's a cartoon character when they see the beautiful thing, their eyes sort of pop out?
Yeah,
the eye stalks. That's what it's sort of like. But yeah, I really think he was a great actor, and I really hate that myth that, oh, the talkies are what ruined John Gilbert because of his voice. That wasn't the case. There's nothing wrong with his voice. You can actually hear him speak. He's in films. Downstairs, I believe, was the name of the film that he was in that was a talkie. His voice is fine. That wasn't the case. But if we get into that, that's going to take a long time. That was a problem with being overpaid by MGM at a point in time when MGM was losing money and they couldn't afford to pay him. So that was what happened to him. So then after the horse manure scene, then they're coming home. They're on their way home. They do several irises in this. Iris dissolves.
Yes.
Which is very D.W. Griffith, I thought. I wondered if
there's a lot of stuff that, I don't know, chicken or the egg kind of thing.
Yeah,
but there's definitely a lot of stuff that I can see other people doing and they did. And
yeah, the iris is really, really
neat. Especially like this era of silent film, everyone's kind of innovating and everyone's doing like cool new stuff. So
yeah, I mean, but that is a very big D.W. Griffith technique. So Ulrich and Leo together coming home on the train, and there at the station waiting for them is Leo's mother and Hertha, who is Ulrich's sister, and nobody else. They have no other family members. Where are they? What has happened to them? We don't know.
They live in big mansions with minimal people inside.
Where is Ulrich's parents are not there. Leo's father, he has no siblings. Very lacking in family, these two, is all I can say. No wonder they've become so close.
It's a movie about friendship, not family.
Yes. And Hertha, we should talk about Hertha. That's, as you said, Barbara Kent. She was a Canadian actress, and they moved to Hollywood at some point. Well, she went to high school in Hollywood. She won the Miss Hollywood pageant, and that's what caught the attention of the studios, and they signed her to a contract at Universal. She was only 18 when she made this film. She looks about 14. She's a mere 4'11". That's how tall she is. She's so tiny. She was selected as one of the Wampas, Baby Stars of 1927.
I love the Wampus Baby Stars. Yeah. If you ever want a rabbit hole to go down, look into the Wampus Baby Stars. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, so, and that was a result of her popularity in the film No Man's Law, where she had a nude scene.
Ooh, risque.
She retired from acting in 1941, and she lived to be 103 years old.
Wow.
Barbara Kent. I really like her in this film.
Yes.
She doesn't seem super inexperienced to me. I think she holds her own very well, especially against Greta Garbo and the more experienced actors. Okay, so they're at the train. They're all happy to see each other. And then John Gilbert gets to do his eyes on the stalk thing because he looks over. Oh, what does he see? There's some beautiful woman there. Who is it? And you look and it's Greta Garbo. Her name in this film is Felicitas.
And all this time, Hertha is also pining over Leo.
She loves Leo. Yep, poor Hertha. So she's getting into her little coat. She drops her flowers on the ground and he runs over. What a gallant guy, that Leo. And he picks up her flowers. He's handing them to her. He's smitten to her. And you hear this very romantic string music. This is kind of a theme that plays throughout this particular romantic theme for Felicitas and Leo. Sometimes, mostly I think when they're together, I don't hear it as much when they're separated. And again, like I said, this Carl Davis music throughout is very, very effective and very good. But she runs off in her carriage and he's like, "Ooh, who is that?" And the mother said, "Oh, maybe some guest coming for the ball." Now we find out apparently there's a ball. You find out a lot of things, not a lot of backstory in any of this.
No.
You're kind of catching up as you go along. So the next part, they're going across the lake on a ferry. Okay, so I looked and this says it was shot in Culver City in the studios, but they look to be on a body of water. Like, I understand we have rear projection, but it at least looks like the water is real. I mean, some of the backdrops look like sets or maybe paintings matted in, but the water looks real to me.
On that sort of same topic, later on in the film, they're walking through snow.
Mm.
I'm like, that looks like pretty real snow, just the way that their foot
the way it was crunching
into
down.
It. So I was like, I don't know what's going on.
I kept wondering, is this somewhere? It said it was only shot at Culver City. It didn't say any other locations, but I keep thinking, is there a location somewhere? They must have at least been by a body of water. They're in a canoe rowing. It looks very realistic. If it's not, it's the best rear projection I've ever seen in my life. I mean, a Hitchcock could take an example from that.
There was a lot of, I don't know if it was rear projection or matte paint. Like, they really did their best to expand the scope of what you were seeing.
Yeah, I mean,
like, physically, there'd be like a little bit of the mansion, but then behind it would be this beautiful, huge mansion.
And I do think you could tell that some of it was clearly painted, some of it was clearly set. So the water to me looked very realistic. So they're going across the lake in the ferry. This is how they get to their mansions or their castles or whatever they have. And as they're going past, they pass this Isle of Friendship. There's a lot of innovative stuff, I feel like, in this particular film, like the flashback sequences. So as they're passing the Isle of Friendship, Leo and Ulrich are talking about the Isle of Friendship, and the mother asks them a question, and then it goes into this flashback of them as boys. And there's a statue there. The statue is very symbolic. There's a statue of, I guess, two boys, two young men, and they're sort of have their wrists connected in the statue. That's their only connection, just the wrists. And then you see the ceremony that the boys are performing, and Hertha is there too as a little girl, and they're cutting themselves with a knife and they're putting their wrists together so they can become what we call blood brothers. A lot of children did this, even in my day and age. This is a very common thing to do. And when they do it right in front of the statue, and they're almost mirroring what the statue looks like. There's more symbolic stuff about that statue later on. But the flashback is very interesting at this point. I mean, I didn't think flashbacks were so prevalent in silent films at that point.
Not especially. Well, and also one of the things that, going back to the unclearness of when the time frame was, their ages, maybe just John Gilbert looks old, even when he's young. He looks old because Hertha had to have been like 5 or 6 maybe.
Yeah.
And then she's 15, almost 16 when they come back.
Yeah.
But John Gilbert looks
30.
Yeah, looks like he's 30.
Oh, poor John. Well, Lars doesn't look that young either, honest.
I mean, was like, the time, there's a lot of weird math going on.
I mean,
on
I'm assuming that if they're in the military, they're probably supposed to be a young man in their late teens, early 20s is what I'm guessing they're supposed to be. So they tell this story in flashback about how they become best friends because of this blood ceremony, and they're united forever, they're best friends, blah, blah, blah. And then they arrive at the castle. Here's another humorous part. The servant lady, he keeps trying to tell her when to throw the flowers, and he's throwing the flowers on this head butler or whatever he is. I don't know what they are exactly. But that part is quite funny as well. And then
when he actually tries to do something serious, that's when she realizes that everyone else threw their bouquets already.
And the guy with the stomach that juts out, and then he pushes the stomach in, and his butt juts out, and then he watches it, and then he finally gives him the flag to hold. And very funny. So the servants are coming out to greet the lord and masters of the castle. And they do say that at some point that Leo is being introduced as a baron. So we know that. And then
it's his ancestral home, like the castle or whatever is his ancestral
home. His ancestral home that lives his mother and him.
Yeah.
This castle.
Not many ancestors left.
And so then the next thing they do is they're going to this ball that has been talked about previously. And little Hertha, she's so excited. She wants to dance with Leo, and Leo he's hugging her, but he's definitely treating her like a kid sister, not like any real interest. And he's looking around the room, and we know he's looking for Felicitas, and then he sees her, and then this image of Greta Garbo, and then a close-up of Greta Garbo. So, yeah, it's very focused on, it really brings out Greta Garbo and her beauty. But I noticed when they first show her, not the first shot when you can see her whole body, but the second shot where it's a more close-up, there is a little sinister piece of the music. You hear a little sinister sound, almost a bassoon or some sort of low-playing instrument.
Yeah, you definitely get some
foreboding
that something's a little off.
Yes, something's not good about this. So he, of course, runs over. He just pretty much flings her aside. Goodbye. And he runs over to Greta. He wants to dance with her, and she gets up and starts dancing. I must say that John Gilbert is always an excellent dancer. He dances in a lot of his movies. He's a fantastic dancer. And then another little funny part, this little boy that wants to dance with Hertha. And she at first rejects him because she comes up to Leo and she says, I have you on my dance card. You're my first dance. And he's pretty much like, oh, is that so? And then he runs off with Felicitas, and she just scratching out his name. And then the little boy comes up and she's like, oh, okay. And she starts to dance with him. And it's really cute.
It took me a minute. I don't think I'd ever physically seen a dance card before.
No.
And then the twins that we meet in seconds.
That's another really funny part.
First I was like, What are they doing? And I was like, dance card. That's literally a dance card.
Yeah, the twin part is very funny, too. And that introduces us to the pastor, who is one of my favorite characters in this film, the pastor. He's so very over the top. Pastor Voss is his name. He's played by George Fawcett. He was a great stage actor on Broadway. He and his wife had their own stock theater company. And he actually didn't get into films until around age 55. But then he made up for lost time by appearing in 100 films in 15 years. And including many D.W. Griffith said he was a favorite of D.W. Griffith. They said he was comparable to John Barrymore on the stage when he was young.
That's high praise.
He's a very interesting fellow in this particular film. I quite like him. So we get introduced to the pastor, and what he's doing is he's sitting in the ball. He's drinking steins of beer, which, again, I guess gives it away that it's German.
Yeah.
And he's looking, and he sees these two twin girls. And then all of a sudden, he's pushing the beer away. He's like, wait, I just saw one girl, and she appeared as twins. And he thinks it's because he has double vision because he's drinking too much. But then some men come over, and they ask the twins to dance. And one twin goes, and the other one stays. And he's like, oh, they are just really twins. Bring more beer. It's really cute.
It's a nice connection between Lars Hansen from Gustav Berling Saga to Pastor Voss, where Lars Hansen was the drinking clergyman to another film where he's not the drinking clergyman this time.
No, and then I don't really know where is Ulrich. Is Ulrich even at this ball? Because I never see him.
I don't know, yeah.
I mean,
he just kind of disappears.
Yeah, I know. It just occurred to me right now, like, is Ulrich there? Because I didn't see him. But because we come to the next scene, which is a very, very famous scene in this movie, very famous scene, where Leo takes Felicitas out into the garden after their dance, and they're sitting there very close together. And this is when she gets a cigarette. She asks him to light her cigarette, and he pulls up a match, which is actually a carbon arc lamp, which is highly, highly hazardous, very high temperature, hazardous thing to hold. And John Gilbert is holding this carbon arc lamp because it did a beautiful job of lighting up their faces. And it lights up, especially Greta Garbo's face, so beautifully. And that's a very famous scene. And he gets this match. He's going to light her cigarette, and she blows the match out. And he said, do you know if you blow a match out, it's an invitation to kiss you? And then she just looks very coy or whatever. She's very seductress-like in this film. And he just kisses her, and that's sort of the beginning of their thing. Because then the next thing you see moves very quickly in this film is he's in her house. They're lounging around. She's on her settee in her beautiful dress, and he's lounging on the floor with his head on her chest. Again, this is a very beautiful job of the lighting, the camera angles, everything. It's very beautiful and romantic. The music, everything. This scene is done so well.
Well, going back to that, when they were lighting cigarettes and stuff, might be a controversial opinion, but I think cigarettes and smoking in movies is one of the coolest things characters can do, because you can learn so much about someone from the way they light their cigarette, the way they hold it, the way they exhale. There's so much about it that can really subtly inform character stuff. And just the way the two interacted over this one cigarette is amazing, and one of the most passionate scenes without being overtly physical or overtly passionate, but you can just feel it there.
Yeah.
And then the way they don't actually smoke, but then the way it wraps up in the next scene.
Yeah.
When he lets out a big, you see a big plume of smoke.
Yeah.
Coming up, it really wraps everything up, that whole bit up.
Yeah, and you know what? The smoke was also a really good feature to use when you're in things like film noirs, and you can use the smoke as a... You can do all sorts of things
a
with smoke.
Set decoration,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, you can do all sorts of things with the smoke, and you can bring it into the ambiance of the film. Yeah, I mean, granted, we don't encourage smoking, but yeah.
In movies only.
Don't encourage smoking in real life, but yes, I don't know if you've seen it. One of my favorite cigarette type things is now Voyager, when he would always light the two cigarettes and give her the other.
I've never seen
it's
that.
So romantic. Oh my God, it's so romantic. Oh, okay, never mind. We're not talking about now Voyager. So they're in the bedroom together. We have to make some assumptions at this point that they're lying in this bedroom together, that probably something may have occurred.
Which would necessitate that cigarette that Leo
yeah,
is smoking.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps something has occurred of a romantic nature here. So everybody's all happy. They're very content, cuddly together. But then what happens, here comes this man. We're like, who is this man? We don't know. But Leo's in the bedroom window.
Leo
and
flicks,
the man
again,
looks up. Yeah.
Again, another character thing. He flicks his
cigarette
smoke out the window.
And the fellow
and
looks
hits
up.
It's the guy, yeah.
He looks up at the window and he's like, what? What's this? And he starts to come up. Another thing they do in this scene, Leo and Felicitas, before this man comes up into the room, is they exchange rings. And I feel like that's a symbolism for being married. They consider themselves married the way they exchange the rings. But anyhow, this man comes in the room. And of course, Leo's like, what's going on? And the man's like, what's going on? The only person that seems to know what's going on is Felicitas. And she just casually tells Leo, oh yeah, this is my husband, Count Radon or whatever his
name
is.
And you realize she has a type because they both look exactly the same almost. They have the same mustache, the same hair.
Mark McDermott,
yes.
He plays the Count Von Radon. Radon?
that was the best I could. That's one of the problems with silent films is there's no one to pronounce things for you. So
it's radon, like that gas that you have nowadays that you don't want in your house. That's what it looks like. Anyhow, so he comes in. Of course, he's not especially pleased. But Leo, he introduces himself. Yeah. Hello, I'm Leo, at your service.
What does
he
do?
He takes his gloves, slaps them. And what does a glove slap in the face indicate? Duel.
But the thing I like about this duel, the card element.
Oh, okay.
I found it interesting that the more honorable thing to kill someone over is cheating at a card game.
Not your wife's.
Because
leaving.
Count Von Radon says, no scandal must touch my name.
Yep.
A dispute at cards will serve as my excuse for killing you.
Yep.
So I like that card cheating is a more honorable way to kill someone.
It's scandalous to defend your honor because your wife has slept with some man, but if you cheated your cards, that's absolutely acceptable.
Yes.
Now we come to this, maybe one of my most favorite artistic scenes in the film is this duel scene. Oh, God.
Well, I got that.
Every time I see this scene, I just, it's so beautifully done, done in the shadow with the tall trees on the side. Oh, gorgeous, gorgeous. I just can't say enough about that.
And the fact that the action happens off screen,
off
on each side. You just see the gun smoke come from each side. So you don't know
what's happened.
What's happened, who's hit who, what's happened until
the next scene.
Yeah.
But what a beautiful, beautiful scene. And I have to think that either William Daniels or Clarence Brown really liked to use smoke. Because you got the smoke coming from the menorah, you got the smoke from the pistols. They must have been like, ooh, we have all these great things we can use smoke with. Like you said, cigarettes are so great in film.
And if you just pause this movie and print it out, that scene, you could hang it on any wall.
It is. It's
and any...
so beautiful. It's almost like an abstract painting in a way.
Yes.
It's absolutely gorgeous.
Very like white and black, negative space kind of thing.
Yeah. I like the scene at the end too. I think that's also very artistically done that we're unfortunately not going to get to talk about, which is really a great scene. But then the next thing it cuts to is you don't know what's happened in the duel, but then you kind of do because the next thing you see is Felicitas putting on a black veil. And we assume she wouldn't be wearing a black veil for somebody that she had an affair with, but nobody knows that she's involved with. And the thing I see, she's looking at herself in the mirror, she's putting on the black veil, but then you see that little sly, devious smile, and you wonder, did she arrange this?
Yeah, she's been a little sketch from the get-go.
Yeah, because it's like, did this just happen by accident, or did she purposely arrange this because she wanted to get rid of the husband?
I didn't think, now that you mention it, that's a good...
Yeah.
That's a good conclusion to draw. Yeah. I didn't think of that immediately, but now knowing how things end up,
yeah,
very possible.
I think she sort of engineered this to happen. And then the next thing is, this is another very beautiful scene in the park where they're in the park and Leo's sitting on a bench with Felicitas. They're trying not to be seen together. He's always hiding behind his collar. And we find out that Leo is going to be sent to Africa because of the duel. The military is sort of punishing him by sending him to Africa for 5 years. And Felicitas is, oh, she's worried about being left alone for so long, not that she's going to miss Leo, or that she wants to do more, like she doesn't want to be left alone. And at one point in the scene, she says, oh, we can't be seen together. And he says, we're unlikely to see anybody we know here. But then as soon as she walks away, Leo's still standing there, who comes walking around, but our friend Pastor Voss, yep. Who was, his back was to them. He was on the bench right behind them, listening to the whole thing.
He's the voice of reason of the
He's
of
trying
the film.
To tell.
Yeah. Not that anyone's listening, but he's
trying.
Doing his best.
He's trying to tell Leo, look, be careful, watch yourself.
Especially in a sermon scene later on.
He
stops being subtle.
No, he gets into his dramatics. That's why I said this guy can be a little over the top, but I like that about him. And at the end of the park scene, they have the man lighting the torches with the flame, which I really, really like that too. I think that's a really beautiful touch in this scene. And then the next thing you see is Leo saying goodbye to his family, and he goes over to Ulrich, and he says, oh, the widow von Radon, the widow von Radon, she's alone, she's unprotected, please go help her, check in on her, whatever. And then I thought this was awfully odd. Well, first of all, as he's leaving, the train's leaving, poor Hertha, she's sitting there very sad that he's leaving, and then he doesn't say goodbye to her, and she's running alongside the train, and she said, you would leave without bidding me goodbye, and he's like, oh, you know, goodbye or whatever, but, you know, you just feel so sorry for her, and she winds up leaning against his pillar, she's watching the train go, tears streaming down her face, but then what I thought was very odd is a little child comes up with a tray of beer, like, what is that? Why is this young boy walking around the train station serving people beer?
I've never been onto a train station, but that seems like my kind of train station.
But a young child. Yeah. He's probably like 8.
we're before labor laws.
And then the next thing that happened is Ulrich goes to visit Felicitas. We can already see that this might not be a good plan. He tells her, oh, I'm friends with Leo. He's asked if he can help. She's disinterested. No, she's not paying attention to him. Then he
says,
oh, well, do you need any money? I'm very rich and my purse is Leo's. And all of a sudden, she's paying attention. Oh, sit down. Blah, blah. She's all gracious all of a sudden. And she asks Ulrich to light her cigarette. This is this thing she does, her seduction technique, giving men to light her cigarette.
That's probably her late deceased husband. That's probably how they.
That's how she got him. She's just everybody falls in love with her upon lighting the cigarette. There's a magic cigarette, maybe. Yep. I don't know. And then, oh, here's another iris here in this one. There's an iris close up of Ulrich, which I really like irises. I know a lot of people don't. I really do. And then you see how nervous he is when he's shaking. He drops the lighter. He's so clumsy. Yeah. He's trying to light her cigarette. And that's all you really see about that. You don't know what else is happening. The next thing you see is that Leo's sitting over there in Africa. Well, you assume it's Africa. There's a flag. I guess that's supposed to indicate Africa. I'm not really sure.
Land out there.
Yeah, it looks like perhaps a bit of a plateau or something. I'm not really plains. I don't know. But yeah, I'm surprised they don't have a sign that says welcome to Africa or something. What he's doing is he's reading a letter, which is a letter from Ulrich saying that now he's free to come home. He's gotten him some sort of a pardon of some sort. And it mentions in the letter he's been away for 3 years. Now, this next montage with him going home, really cool stuff. I'm assuming this is the editor, where they show her face, Felicitas's face, sort of in transparency as he's sitting there. She's basically a floating head throughout the montage of him going home. But I don't think that was very common to do back then.
No. And we get a little bit of it, too, at the end point, in the end game of the movie.
Yeah. That we can't talk about at the end point. Yeah. But when was that first done? Because I don't think I've seen that in a silent film before that.
No, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. And also, when it says her name.
Yeah, Felicitas.
That brought back memories
of Dr. Caligari.
Captain of Dr. Caligari.
I imagine that has to be the editor that we should credit for that.
Yeah.
Something that was done in editing. I wrote cutting edge editing.
And I like it because it was something I wasn't expecting. Even when you see her face imposed over everything, it wasn't.
No.
I was not ready for that.
Well,
not, like,
yeah,
wow,
certainly
really,
not 1926.
Really cool. Yeah.
You didn't expect it. And I noticed that there's different music themes throughout. Sometimes it's very marchy. This is one of the times when the music is very much like a march. It was like that when they're first going into the ball. There's a processional march type sound. And just the music throughout really suits the mood of what they're doing on the screen. So he gets to wherever they live. I don't know. And Ulrich is waiting for Leo, and he makes some sort of comment like, oh, you didn't tell my mom, like he's going to sneak in and surprise her. And first, they're very excited to see each other. And Ulrich is like, oh, come over here with me. And Leo's coming along. He's like, oh, come to the carriage. And he looks in the carriage, and who's sitting in the carriage but Felicitas, all very coy again, I guess is the word to use for her. And at first, I think he thinks that she's come to greet him. And he's excited. And then the bomb drops, and Ulrich said, this is my wife, and his face. And then this is...
Speaking of faces, though, watching Garbo did so much without saying anything in this scene. Just the way she looks at him.
She looks very shifty to me.
Yeah, yeah. Just the stuff she was able to convey, the emotion she was able to convey just with her face and her eyes alone is pretty amazing.
She was known for that. That was her great talent. And you hear a little bit of the sinister sound in the music again at this point. And Leo, I guess, finally recovers himself because, of course, he's like totally shocked. And he manages to congratulate Ulrich. And then she's like, oh, come on, he must be tired. Let's take him home. And he's like, no, no, no. Apparently, he's going to walk to wherever his home is. So you can see Ulrich is downtrodden. Now, what Ulrich thinks, mistakenly, is that seeing the widow Countess von Radon has brought back these terrible memories of the duel.
Yeah.
Ulrich has no idea that Leo had any kind of involvement with Felicitas, so he's completely clueless to that. So the only thing he can think is that Leo's is upset with him for bringing this woman back into his life. He's just downhearted. It's really sad.
Ulrich's part of a love triangle that he has no idea even exists.
No, yeah, poor Ulrich. He's completely clueless. He knows something is wrong, but he doesn't know what's wrong. And he's just upset and he's depressed. His little head is hanging down, Lars Hansen. So then Leo winds up going home and he sneaks up and surprises his mother. First of all, he spies on them for a little bit. And coincidentally enough, they just so happen to be talking about him at that exact point. And he's spying on them and he doesn't make his presence known because the dogs in the dog houses start barking. And this is the second time when they show dogs. They showed dogs at the military thing, too. They showed a bunch of dogs coming out of a 1,000 dogs coming out of one little dog house.
There's a lot of recurring...
what is it with the dogs?
Recurring smoke, recurring dog.
Anyhow, the dogs start barking, and that gives him away. So he comes around, and he greets them, and Hertha runs off. And he's like, well, what's she do? Why is she running off like that? And she's like, well, she's not dressed. She's a young lady now. I guess she's now 18, because she says later on that she's 18 now, I think. And then she says that Hertha is now living with her since Ulrich got married to Felicitas. Because, you know, that big castle that Ulrich has is not enough for the three of them.
It's so full. There's so many people living in it.
We can't have the sister there, too. And then the next thing that happens is there's a scene in the Leo home, I guess we'll call it, with a bunch of people visiting. Felicitas and Ulrich are there. We don't see these people arrive. They just randomly are in the room. So, and then the pastor is also there. And I thought this was an interesting thing they did with the camera, too, because they come in the room and they sort of spotlight the guest and then pan to the next guest, spotlight them. It's done in I don't really know what you would call the way they do that, but it's very interesting. It almost reminds me of some sort of a mystery film where you're showing the suspects. You know what I mean? That's what it reminded me of.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly on that.
Yeah, so an interesting thing here that I want to point out in this particular scene is this pipe. Did you see this pipe that the pastor is smoking?
Yes. At first, I didn't realize what it was because it looked like a pipe, but it looked like it was like taped together or like it was broken, but taped. And it wasn't until he was standing at a certain angle that I was like, I see what that is now.
Yeah, so what it is called is a meerschaum cigar holder. Is a soft, porous clay mineral which dissipates heat very rapidly, giving the user a cool smoke. It's used to make cigar and cigarettes holders and conventional tobacco pipes. That's what the pipe was called. But it looks very much to me, and I could be wrong, like a naked lady is on his pipe.
Yeah, I couldn't pick out, when I was watching, not the highest definition copy, but it was some sort of form. I couldn't quite...
I thought it looked like a naked lady, I could be wrong, especially considering his speeches throughout that he would have a pipe like that. But anyhow,
he has one of my favorite quotes of the whole movie in this little bit.
The what?
But he has one of my favorite quotes from the whole movie. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. You
This is a scene where I don't know if we're quite there yet.
Okay. Well, what I have here is that Alric doesn't understand why Leo's upset about Felicitas. He's saying, oh, does it really bother you so much to see the widow of Count Von Radon? And then poor Leo, what is he supposed to say? No, it bothers me that you've married the woman that I'm in love with, that I had an affair with, and that he can't say that. So he basically doesn't really say anything, but then Alric is... He knows something is wrong and he's very upset. But then the pastor comes over. It's a very weird scene because the pastors come over and they're standing either sideways or back to back at first. And then there's this weird cut and they're both facing the thing. And the pastor is looking with these very weird eyes. His eyes look very strange. He's like, obviously you can't see my face, but his eyes are like very strange looking and very angry. And this is when he's talking about, maybe this is a speech you're talking about, the devil using women to lure men.
He says, my boy, when the devil cannot reach us through the spirit, he creates a woman beautiful enough to reach us through the flesh.
Yep. And I think
that's awesome.
And that kind of also reflects the title, Flesh and the Devil. Yes. I think that's where that comes from. And it's interesting because I think it foreshadows to something later on, in my opinion. And then as he's saying this, he's smoking a pipe with potentially a naked woman on. We don't know. It looks like it.
Which wouldn't be out of character because he does drink.
True.
Quite a bit.
Yes, he's quite the hypocritical pastor. Maybe that's also
he's
a point that was that a point also that Suderman was trying to make about pastors and religion. Next thing that happens, Felicitas sends a note to meet her at the Isle of Friendship to talk. There's a beautiful mist over the water here in this scene. And again, he comes over. He's in a boat. He's in the water. I don't know. I'm bewildered by this water situation. And then Felicitas is telling Leo she still loves him and she's trying to convince him to come because she's worried about Ulrich's suffering. And she's on her knees begging him, looking very fetching. Greta Garbo is so good at hanging her neck way back. I mean, she does that in a lot of her movies. She has really limber neck muscles or something.
And her logic, I found her logic very fascinating. I think this is the part where she was playing. She doesn't want Ulrich to be sad that she left. So in order for Leo to keep Ulrich happy, he needs to stay meeting with Felicitas, have an affair with Felicitas to keep Ulrich happy.
She's very manipulative.
Some good mental gymnastics.
Very manipulative, and she knows what is working on Leo.
And especially having this meeting at the Isle of Friendship. She knows the whole backstory of it. So it's especially
it's like emotional blackmail.
Getting to him by doing it here, of all places.
So, yes, he finally agrees that he'll come over and he'll meet Ulrich. He'll come to the house. And now, if you look, they showed the statue again. But if you pay attention, a tree has fallen through the statue.
And
you can no longer see the boys joined.
I couldn't tell if they were broke, if it had broken
through. If it was
broken,
or you just couldn't see that. You can't see that they're joined
anymore.
Either
way,
it's very, very significant and symbolic, in my opinion. The next scene, Leo is waiting to see Ulrich. He came to see Ulrich. There's some beautiful light beams coming down from the window in this scene that I noticed. For some reason, Ulrich is sitting there playing an organ.
Weird Phantom of the Opera vibes to it. Just seclusion and this big place.
This huge pipe organ. He's sitting there by himself playing a pipe organ. Okay, whatever. So then Leo's pretending everything's okay to try to make Ulrich happy. And then I thought this part was pretty symbolic as well. He pours 3 glasses of port or whatever. They look like port glasses. And they do a little toast. And as they toast, Ulrich's glass breaks or something. And he's cut himself and he's bleeding. And he's tending to his cut. And meanwhile, there's this look that passes between Felicitas and Leo. And they toast each other. And it's very...
The way she takes a sip as it fades out is...
Yeah. She is dreadful. She is dreadful. Poor Leo. He doesn't have any chance at all. This is the scene you were talking about before. This is the church scene.
Yes.
So here, this is a little funny here. The pastor, he's looking at his book, his Bible book, and he has this little thing that says, today's sermon is going to be, and then it says, love thy neighbor as thyself. And he's like, oh, okay. And he turns the page to start talking about the sermon, and what happens? Down the aisle comes Leo and Felicitas together. He's escorting her down the aisle, and behind is Ulrich and the mother, and they go into their pews, and all of a sudden his face is like fury, like so angry.
And he goes off script.
Yeah, he says, that sermon is David doing evil and his deeds stinking to high heaven.
Yeah,
and I was just like, that's the sermon?
Very hardcore fire and brimstone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
About jealousy and Ulrich's covet
wife,
thy neighbor.
Or Uriah's wife, and David has lain with Uriah's wife, and then he's slain Uriah, and
And as he's speaking, he's like really, really, really overdramatically angry and very, and John Gilbert keeps looking like shocked and horrified. But then you see Felicitas, she's putting on her lipstick. Yeah, she's highly unconcerned, like, oh, I don't care what this pastor is saying. But then at the end, when he's like, he will suffer in the fire of heaven and blah, 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 blah. And Leo's very shocked and she's now fainted. At first, I thought she was sleeping, actually.
That's exactly until
he got the smelling salts. I thought she'd fall. She was so bored.
That's exactly what I saw.
I thought that would have been even better. They should have had her fall asleep. And then the next thing that happens is they come up for the communion. Ugh. And so he's giving them all the wine and they're all in the row. And as soon as he gives somebody the wine, he turns the cup, right? Which, you know, is so sanitary, really. I mean, that keeps all the germs away. Yeah. But anyhow, this is in either 1914 or perhaps 1926. We don't know exactly when this is.
But
so he's doing this. And as he comes to Leo, he drinks out of it. He turns the cup and she grabs the cup and she turns it back to where he drank. And she drinks the same way. And she drinks so seductively out of this cup, like she's kissing the cup is what it looks like. And then Leo is staring at her in this shocked fashion. And then it cuts to Hertha, who's praying very piously. And I think it's significant that they did it like that, that they showed her like that, as if contrasting evil and good.
Hertha's prayers later on that'll play a bit of a part in things.
Yep. So then there's a scene outside. There's a lot of snow. Here's one of the snow scenes. There's a lot of snow outside. I hope they didn't use asbestos because
that's the first thing I thought.
For snow in the Wizard of Oz.
I
hope they didn't use asbestos.
Their lungs are all messed up after this movie.
Well, Barbara Kent didn't have to go out in this asbestos snow, so she lived to be 103.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the part of what took down John Gilbert. Anyhow, then it shows the interior. Hertha is trying to clean up Leo's desk, and he starts yelling at her. He's being really mean to her. And she said, I'm not taking this anymore, and she's throwing his papers all around. And she starts to go up the stairs, and who's at the door? Felicitas. And you can just see, Hertha doesn't like Felicitas, and she knows something is awry with this situation. But Felicitas grabs her. She pretends she's her best friend. She's like, oh, she came to see Leo. And then she comes to see Leo and she's talking. She's like, we can't talk here. We need to go out alone. And they go out in the snow. And Hertha is watching them from the window go off into the snow. And eventually, this is when she's telling, I'm going to leave Ulrich if you don't take me away. And it's like, what is that logic? And then again, I have a note that there's an iris again here. And then she's showing her feet that she's cold standing in the snow. So conveniently, there's just this empty house with a fire.
When we say it was snowing, it's not just a faint.
Yeah, there's less snow.
There were parts where it was sometimes tough to see what was going on. There was so much snow.
Snow whatever it is. Yeah, whatever that was. But here's this random house that just happens to be open. There just happens to be a fire in the fireplace, but there's nobody there. Is this an estate? Is this a guest house? I don't know.
She poked her head in first to see what was going on.
Yeah.
And when she saw no one there.
Because most people, when they leave their house, they just leave fires burning.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, no problem, but whatever.
You never know when a lover's tryst may unexpectedly occur.
Left it there just in case. Yeah. So they, of course, she's like, oh, look, here's the nice place with a fire. She starts whipping off her clothes, right? She's got her fur off. She's got her gloves off. She's taking off her shoes. She's getting all cozy by the fire. She's beckoning him over. Come over, you know.
That was a really, really nice dress. I'm no fashion expert, but I really dug everyone's
She looks beautiful
clothes.
Throughout.
And he had a pretty nice fur coat, if I may.
Fur coat. Yes, they both. And he's sitting there away from her in his fur coat. He's pretty much covered all the way up to the face, trying to avoid being exposed, I guess. I don't know. And finally, she convinces him to come over. He takes off his coat. I noted the firelight flickering on her face. Again, really beautiful. So Leo wants to tell Ulrich what's going on. He's really distressed by the whole situation. And she continues to manipulate him and try to seduce him. She proposes they should run away together. And finally, she seduces him to the point that he's like, yes, let's run away together. Let's do it. And so she's like, okay, well, come to my house. Come get me. And they make these plans. And so the next thing that happens is we're at Felicitas' house. And she's getting ready to leave. She's packed up. She's got suitcases sitting there. She's packing. She's tells her maid, tell me as soon as he gets here. But what happens? Instead of Leo showing up, Ulrich shows up. So she immediately is in this, where they're hiding the suitcases in the closet. She's putting a dressing gown over her dress to try to pretend she's in bed. And Ulrich comes in and he says, oh, I have something for you. And it's this beautiful diamond bracelet. And she's like, oh, this bracelet. And then all of a sudden you can see her head working. This is, again, great job by Greta Garbo of just expressing with her body movement and her eyes. You can see looking at the bracelet, thinking, do I want to give up all this luxury? Do I want to throw this away?
I have actually a quote from director Clarence Brown about Greta Garbo's face, if you would like to,
hear
it. Director Clarence Brown would say, "She had something behind the eyes that told the whole story that I couldn't see from my distance. On the screen, Garbo multiplied the effect of the scene I had taken. It was something she had that no one else ever had."
Yeah. Yeah.
And you see that. Yeah, all through the movie.
It's true. She was famous for that, and she was really good at it. And I don't think we really said much about Greta Garbo. Obviously, she's a Swedish actress. Now, when she was a child, she lived in poverty. They were very impoverished. Her father died when she was 14. He had contracted the Spanish flu, and I guess he had health problems and then wound up dying eventually. She started out as a model, and she did some commercials, and she was noticed by Moritz Stiller. Like you mentioned, he's a Finnish director, and he would begin to put her in films and become her friend and mentor. Maybe something else. It's kind of vague. It's not really certain.
We'll say muse.
But supposedly Louis B. Mayer came over. He was interested in Stiller as a director, and Stiller insisted Greta come along. He made Louis B. Mayer watch some sort of a film she was in, and Louis B. Mayer was like, whoa, no, wait. Don't worry about Stiller. We need this girl. So they both came over. He brought them both over to the States.
And she even for her small role in Gösta Berling's Saga, one of her first movies.
Yeah.
Like that, it's a very small role, but often garners all the attention from a really great movie, but it's always got that attachment, Garbo's earliest film or one of Garbo's earliest, despite how great it is.
Yeah, and then she was nominated for 4 Oscars, and I think she's best known for Camille, which she's fantastic in that movie, and Ninotchka. But that's a little bit about Greta Garbo. And like I said, first of all, she had the screen presence. She was beautiful. She had the screen presence. And then she had this way of making her face do things and her eyes do things that really conveyed everything she was thinking.
And I think, I don't know if you're planning to talk about this later, but the Garbo-Gilbert connection.
Romance.
Definitely added. They had amazing chemistry.
Well, yes.
And you can definitely see how things started smoldering around this
movie.
Then
that did start during this film. They started a passionate love affair during this film, and that's why the shots, the love scenes are very passionate and steamy and romantic. That really adds to the film, and it said that they would be so involved with each other that the director, Clarence Brown, would just tell everybody, come on, get out of here, let's go, and they just all leave, and then they'd send them up some dinner later on.
I believe it. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
Even from early on, you could tell there was something outside of acting.
Oh, yeah. And we have to remember at this point, Greta Garbo is not a big star. She's basically an unknown. But John Gilbert is a huge star at this point. At this point, John Gilbert is the big star. Greta Garbo is basically a nobody. So she comes into this film and she's working with one of the most popular, biggest, most famous actors in all of Hollywood. And from what I understand, he was very helpful to her in coaching her during this film, coaching her with her acting. And she really counted on him and trusted him for that sort of thing. He gave her his business manager so he could help her in her career.
And she still wasn't a fluent English speaker at this point. So he was able to...
Well, handy to have Lars Hansen, too.
Yeah.
She had somebody she could communicate with.
Yeah, he was able to help whenever she needed retakes or when he saw something was made her uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He had the stroke to call for another take or call for
and
another
look. He did. He was very gracious.
Yeah.
John Gilbert was a very good guy.
Yeah.
If you ever read anything about John Gilbert, the one thing you've come across is that John Gilbert was a good guy. So anyhow, back to Felicitas. So he gives her the bracelet, and now she's in a quandary. What should she do? And we see what happens. The bracelet wins. The not wanting to give up the luxury wins because Ulrich goes somewhere else. And Leo comes up. And I like the scene because she's standing in the bed, holding aside the bed curtains, and she's the only thing lit in the scene. It looks like a siren calling somebody.
Yeah.
You know, it's so awesome. And she tells Leo she's not going with Leo, but she wants to stay here and stay with Ulrich, but then continue to just have an affair. And this is when he becomes horrified, outraged. He's yelling at her. Then he starts strangling her.
Yeah, like, he's been tricked for the last time.
Yeah, he's strangling her she's really...
It was very real. Not that I've ever strangled anybody.
No, thank goodness.
Or seen a real strangulation.
Yeah, but like, it looks
very realistic. The way he was doing it, his fingers were really getting in there.
And, you know, like her neck realistic. Is so bendy. So
yeah.
It was very.
I was like, this looks a little, made me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, I actually thought, like, when he was on the bed and he was putting all his weight into the strangling, I thought, I'm surprised she's still alive at this point. But she is still alive. But who bursts in the room but Ulrich? I don't know how he knows what's going on in the bedroom. Maybe she was shouting. We don't know. And he comes in, and there, this music now is a very angry, clashing type of music. Leo releases her. She's on the bed clutching her throat, which I'm sure didn't feel very good at that point. And Ulrich's like, what are you doing here? What's going on? At this point, he's not exactly sure what's happening. But Felicitas runs over to him and does her little imploring, begging thing on her knees that she does so well, saying, he's mad. He tried to force me to leave with him. And Leo gets angry, like he's going to attack her again. And then he sort of slumps down. He said, it's true. Shoot me. And at that point, you're like, what do you mean shoot you? But then you know that Ulrich is holding a gun, which I didn't see before that part. I was like, oh, well, he does have a gun. And he comes up real close to Leo and puts the gun at him. And he says, I'm not going to shoot you when you can't defend yourself. And they agree to have a duel. All of a sudden, you see this tear running down Leo's face. And he says, where does he want to have the duel? And Ulrich says, the Isle of Friendship, which just so symbolic.
This whole movie is very, not having read the original book, but the movie itself is very Shakespearean, very... Something I could imagine.
Very gothic.
Yes, very.
It has a gothic feel to it.
Very tragic, very tragic feel to it.
Yeah, and then we're going to have to stop soon, but I want to get a couple more things in before, because I don't want to give away. But the next thing you see is Leo was walking across the frozen lake to the Isle of Friendship, which is a really cool scene, too. It's a beautiful scene. This is going to be cutting back and forth. Here's some cross-cutting, I guess, in this. Leo's walking across, and then the next thing, Hertha is in the room with Felicitas saying, stop this. You know, you have to stop this. She's pleading with her, but now Felicitas is in this trance. She's not responsive at all. She's not responding. It's like she doesn't even know that Hertha is there. And Hertha's raging and pleading and raging and pleading, and then she goes to the window and she's in the light of the window and she's praying, and my God, she looks exactly like an angel, doesn't she? Exactly like an angel. And then the next thing you see is Leo is on the Isle of Friendship. They're in the snow. They're getting their guns out. And then Felicitas starts noticing that Hertha's making all these prayers and she's saying them aloud, and all of a sudden Felicitas comes out of her trance and she sees her praying, and she starts getting very angry and raging at her and raging at her, and she's almost having like this epileptic fit. And it's almost like you wonder, is Hertha's prayer driving the demon from her? That was my thought.
That's what because especially Hertha's, outside of Ulrich, Hertha's the most innocent
she's innocent and pure
person that can,
and pious.
So
that's just all I could think of. And then I thought, woman in the form of a devil. All of a sudden, she goes through this thing, this fit that she's having. And when that subsides, suddenly there's a renewed peace. And she looks at Hertha and she comes over and she clasps her and loves her. And you have to think, is this the demon fleeing from her? She's been restored to peace. But then we will not tell you what else happens. Which is such a shame, because the end scene is so beautiful and, again, has one of those wonderful montage things. Ugh, I wish we could talk about it because it's so amazing. So that's basically Flesh and the Devil. Is there anything else you wanted to mention?
That it was a really good movie. For not ever having heard of it or knew much about it, other than a name on a filmography, really don't know why this isn't with some of the like all-timers.
Let's get it up there, Stuart.
Especially for everyone involved, why this doesn't exist in an easily obtainable format.
Yeah, why haven't they done a Blu-ray restoration on this?
Yeah, like Garbo, Gilbert, everyone involved. It's not like it's an indie film, you know.
Well, Clarence Brown maybe wasn't the most famous of directors, but still, I mean, he was. I mean, it's not like he was nobody. Actually, Felicitas was first conceived for Lillian Gish. They wanted Lillian Gish to play. Lillian Gish playing the Temptress. Yeah. I would think Lillian Gish would do better in the Hertha role.
Yeah.
I could see Lillian Gish very well in the Hertha role, but MGM, this is another example, MGM was paying Lillian Gish $800,000 a year, along with full creative control. And they thought maybe they might give it to Greta Garbo, who was contracted at $450 a week.
Well, that helps.
Funny. And
it was a film that fed into both John Gilbert and Greta Garbo's known public persona.
Yeah. Like the seductress Greta Garbo and the great lover John Gilbert.
Yeah.
Greta Garbo actually tried to refuse to do this film because she found out at this point that her sister was dying of cancer. She wanted to go home and be with her sister who was dying. And they told her, no way, you're not. And if you do, we might consider deporting you. So she had to stay. I mean, I guess silver lining, this made her a big star, this film.
And the thing that's scary about it was, especially back then, a lot of the people in power had the stroke to make that stuff happen.
And that was the least of the things that they might do to a female.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So anyhow, that is Flesh and the Devil.
On that happy ending note.
Yeah, on a pleasant note. So I think you know what we're going to do now. We're going to have our star ratings. What would you rate Flesh and the Devil?
Out of 5, correct?
Out of 5, correct.
It's definitely high fours. My only nitpick about it is the comedy at the beginning, it's a little bit of jarring.
Yeah.
The way it, when you look at it in totality, the comedy at the beginning, while I enjoyed it, doesn't fit the tone of the rest of the film. But that's just me being nitpicky and trying to say something bad about an amazing movie.
And you know what? You would think that if they were going to throw some comedy in, they should do it a la Alfred Hitchcock and put it in where you need some comic relief because you have such heavy scenes. The scenes are heavy. They're emotional scenes. This is an emotional film.
Yes.
You're going to have an emotional response to this film. I don't know what to tell you if you don't, but I'm telling you, I had a very emotional response to this film. I will give this 4.5, which is a super high rating for me because, like I said, it is probably one of my favorite silent films. It's a very beloved film for me. It's the first silent film I saw. I adore it. The cinematography is amazing. It's so wonderful for 1926. The editing, I think there's some very cutting edge editing in here. The acting, of course, wonderful throughout.
We didn't get to talk much about it, but Lars Hansen was phenomenal.
I really do like Lars Hansen. A really great movie is The Wind. Him and Lillian Gish in The Wind. He's wonderful in that film. And the music, everything, every aspect of this film to me is excellent.
Yes.
So, I mean, I
can't disagree with you on that one.
I don't quite give it a 5 because that's reserved for very special films, but this is definitely a strong 4.5.
I agree completely.
Well, anyhow, if you have anything else you want to mention?
Just if you want to learn more silent film stuff, more weird silent film detours, come on over to the Golden Silent Films podcast. We're available on all podcast outlets, and you can find us on Twitter or X and Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely. You should definitely check out the Golden Silent Films podcast with Stuart. It's very interesting, especially if you love silent films or you have an interest in silent films and you want to learn about them. It's a perfect place to learn some stuff. And I want to thank you so much for being a guest today, Stuart.
Thanks
it was good
for
to have
me
you
back
by
again.
Yeah. So maybe we'll see you again sometime. Always like to talk about silent films. And for Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy's Classic Film Review, this is Wendy saying goodbye.
Thank you for listening to our podcast today. Please don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. And please leave us a comment or a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Intro and outro music composed by Heidi Engel. Artwork by Tyler Birch. Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick. Recorded at PCTV Studios, Pittsburgh, PA. See you next time.